Mekudeşit on air.
Broadcasting from Filbeit on the Jerusalem Seam Line.
Josh, welcome to Oppo in the City, all right?
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see you too, man. Okay, basically this episode is about, not the episode, the series is about Jerusalem, where everything went wrong, and how do we come out of this ditchy mud, or muddy ditch, as we call it.
The swamp.
The swamp, exactly. You are a Jerusalemite, right? You moved here?
I moved here when I was 8. I'm originally from Detroit.
All right.
But I grew up here.
Another swamp.
Another swamp, exactly. But I grew up here. And when people ask me where I'm from, no matter where I am, I say I'm from Jerusalem. And then they'll say to me, yeah, but you're from the States. And I'm like, yes, I was born in Detroit. But I grew up in Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is the city that shaped me, shaped my personality, shaped my way of life, my way of looking at things, understanding things.
Those blue eyes of yours that have broken many hearts around many corners in the world.
The blue eyes are actually from Romania. And that's
Romania?
From, yes, yes.
You never told me you had Romanian origins.
They come from my grandmother and my great-grandmother.
So, really?
Yes.
Which part of Romania do you know?
Yes, I do.
Don't tell me Transylvania.
No, it's a city called Chernovitz. And today it is in the Ukraine. And when my family left in the 1890s, it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was part of Romania. And Chernovitz is where the Jewish Enlightenment movement started.
So look at you.
It's a very interesting
legacy.
Very interesting city. And actually, I went there to try and find some of my family roots about 8 years ago. But did
you want to find out if your family were spearheading the Jewish intelligentsia?
Well, I wanted to basically see if I could find any gravestones of my relatives.
And
I didn't. It was impossible. The whole Jewish cemetery there is like covered in.
But you're sure your family comes from there?
Parts of it, yeah. Well, the blue eyes. You mentioned the blue eyes, and the blue eyes come from that specific city called Chernovitz.
People are hearing us, but people don't see your blue eyes. Josh, let me explain who you are as far as I know, all right? Josh is a Jerusalemite filmmaker, but he's more known for his blue eyes and his sense of fashion, his impeccable sense of fashion that you can, it stands out 20 miles away in Jerusalem with all the different attires that people have on, you'll know, oh wait, that's Josh. I know that hat, I know those glasses, and I know them blue eyes, right? But we're not here to talk about Josh's blue eyes.
No,
there is a limit.
No.
We're here to talk about his art, his film, and, you know, because you explored Jerusalem through your, let's talk about the short videos that you, the short films that you've made, because your short videos tackle Jerusalem through different characters, different stories. You've made a short film about the Pride March of 2002.
The first ever Pride March in Jerusalem in 2002. I made a 20-minute film about it.
And people were not very welcoming.
No.
Right?
People, but that's why I wanted to make the film. That was, for me, the idea. The film is called Jerusalem Pride, and it's a very interesting story because when I grew up here in the 90s, I was exposed to a lot of gay and lesbian people and the whole scene. There was a scene here.
Yeah.
Although I am straight. I have a lot of friends, and that community always meant something to me. And then when the first Pride March happened, I was already not living here, but I was visiting here for the summer, and I took my camera and I just documented the whole vibe on the street prior to the Pride March.
And the hostility.
And the hostilities and the madness.
Which is the syndrome and everything. But to me, it's interesting because I grew up in part of the city where, you know, Pride March never meant anything to us, because I'm sure some of the listeners know I'm not Jewish. You know, I grew up in the Armenian Quarter, and bureaucratically speaking, I was growing up in East Jerusalem. I was an East Jerusalemite, and for us, we had too many problems to care about Pride, to care about whatever LGBTQ+ and all that.
And Me Toos and all these things.
And all that. We had other problems.
Yeah.
So to me, it's always interesting that...
To you, it's remote.
It's so remote. It still is. You know, at a certain point, like I cannot confidently say that you and I probably share friends right now from that a community. There, but I can tell you, if they told me Apo come to Pride March 2022, I'd tell them, look, I'm with you. But don't you think the city has a bit of, you know, other problems that we have to solve first?
There's a scene in that film where it's actually one of the most beautiful scenes. There's a guy in the film. He's a religious guy. And I'm talking to him. And he's against it. Mm. But he understands the need for the community to. And he's saying, but why Jerusalem? And I say to him, because they live here. And he says, I'm willing to pay for buses for them to go to Tel Aviv. You know, why not Tel Aviv? Tel Aviv, you can do anything there, but Jerusalem is Jerusalem. And that's where I think our conversation can really start to begin, because there's a mosaic in this city that does not exist in other cities around the world, no matter what city you throw me in, if it's Berlin or London or New York.
Detroit,
where I come from. I mean, every city has a mosaic, but the roots in Jerusalem are so complicated, are so diverse, are so tragic, triumph. I mean, it's everything, and that's what makes this city very different than any other city that I've at least been to. I can tell you that the only other city that I felt that I actually lived in that I felt that there was a little bit of Jerusalem in was actually Montreal.
Because
Montreal is a city that is divided
between the French and the Anglos,
between the Anglophones and the Francophones, and you can feel it. You can feel it, not on the magnitude of Jerusalem, of course, but you can feel it. And of course, you know, Berlin has hundreds of different ethnicities and stuff like this, but that's easy, man. Because here we're dealing with.
Okay, then let me ask you a provocative question.
Please.
Knowing that Jerusalem is a powdered keg,
yeah,
right, of different religious groups and ethnic groups and all that, adding to it the political problems, you know, the political climate, do you think it's wise to put in, to say, okay, that's where we're going to do Pride March, as if, like, you know, you just want to add more wood to the fire? Do you think that's the wisest thing to come to a powder keg of a city and be like, yeah, let's do another one. Let's add another problem.
Listen, on one hand, you're right. Like, why do it here? Why even go there? There's so many.
Because a Pride March might actually, you know, well, there are conservatives in the city that are both Jewish and Arab, and they might actually unite and say, allo, what? This is Jerusalem.
And they did in 2006. There was World Pride here. World Pride.
Oh, really?
And the muftis and the rabbis and the priests all got together. There was a press conference and everything.
Yeah.
I thought that was beautiful that everybody actually united against, you know, whatever. But it's true. And again, because it is what it is, she is what she is, Jerusalem. She's a 3,000-year-old woman, you know, who has seen everything, you know, just like the Paul Simon song, Silent Eyes, if you know the song. It's the last song on one of his amazing albums called Still Crazy After All These Years. The last song is called Silent Eyes, and it is a song about Jerusalem that Paul Simon wrote. And it's a very beautiful song. And you know, yes, why do a Pride March in Jerusalem? Why throw more gasoline into the fire? You know, one thing that people are not in this city are people are not tolerant in this city. And it was a mess. And for me as a filmmaker, I did a film about this. The film that I did is not about the march. It's not about the drag queens. And you only see that in the last minute of the film.
Yeah.
The film is about the mood on the street prior to the march and wacky stuff that people said to me and really wacky stuff and very scary stuff too. And that's what I'm interested in telling. That's what interests me.
And moving on from, you know, people saying wacky stuff and the mood on the street.
Yeah.
Your other short films have to do with characters. Well, like individual characters.
But that's exactly. And
that could be wacky because I've watched some of them. Yeah, they could also be wacky.
They have to be wacky because, you know, if they're not wacky. Listen, my work is based on character. Like I do documentaries. Okay, I am not interested in fiction. I'm not interested in scripted stuff. I'm interested in the real person. Okay, right. So for example, One of the short films that I did is called Jerusalemite, and it is about an elderly man named John Tlil, who is a Palestinian Christian, Greek Orthodox, and he basically, the whole film, he's just repeating himself over and over and over again that it's not easy to be Jerusalemite and it's difficult and it's.
But he has. But he said it's a mission.
It well, he had. He wrote a book called "I Am Jerusalem."
Yeah.
Okay, and it's 900 pages, man. Okay, so I can tell you that I didn't read the book before I filmed with him, but basically, I want his story. I want his footsteps. I want his.
But do you understand Jerusalem better when you meet these characters and you do films about them?
Do I understand?
Having done these short films, do you know something about Jerusalem that I don't? Do you know something about it that we don't?
Listen, it's a personal journey, okay? And if I see something, I'm going to interpret it different than you interpret it, and especially you living in the old city, you know the old city. I would say that you definitely know the old city better than I do. However, when you're behind a camera and the camera's rolling, you can film something, and then you, while you're filming it, you say, it's not that really, and then you go into the editing room, and it's a completely different experience. That's cinema. Then you throw a character like John Tlil, and you're saying to yourself, but he's just repeating himself over and over again and over and over again, and then you use that as a motive, as a motive in the film, to because people tend to repeat themselves a lot, and it's normal.
Yeah.
And I use that as an element, kind of like as an experimental, trippy kind of thing in the film, where the music and him repeating himself is kind of like an LSD trip, you know. So. And it's a short, and I like shorts, but I like portraits. I like to do portraits on people, and I'm not saying that people in Tel Aviv are less interesting, but people here, living in this city and in this environment, have so much more. They have so much more at risk. They have so much more wrapped around them. They have so much more history, connection, good, bad, evil, happy, sad. It's so much more. The electricity here, the characters here, for me, they speak to me. They speak to me. I'm not saying that I identify with them, but they speak to me at the eye level that I need.
I see that, but that's why I was asking. So these characters that speak to you, do they give you a hint about Jerusalem? Do they give you a hint about where Jerusalem might go or where it's going?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I feel like it's not going to a... Not that it's going to a bad place. I'm just... not sure where it is going, you know? And the characters that, you know, of your short films that I watch, they also seem to be lost. They also seem to be in a limbo, you know? Because if a guy comes to you and tells you, like John Tlil, I am Jerusalem, and then I watch the short, I am the Byzantian.
I am Constantine the Great.
I am Constantine the Great. And then the other short film about, you know, the Pride March, where the hostilities... And look, I have my own reservations about the Pride March in Jerusalem, because... I rarely see Palestinian, and if you're not addressing the elephant in the room, which is, you know, the inequality that half of the city faces, then what Pride March are you talking about, you know? And then another short film where you documented the municipal elections of 2009, people just yelling at each other and saying, oh, this politician is corrupt, that politician is corrupt. Then you had another short film about the Knight of Jerusalem, right? This guy who's fourth generation Jerusalemite.
Knight of Peace.
Knight of Peace. You know, to me, it just seems like a mosaic or a kaleidoscope of characters coming from different walks of life, but ending up in the same ditch at the end of the day. You know, where they want to feel like they have a grasp of Jerusalem. You know, they want to feel like they do because they're bringing their legacy with them, their heritage, whether it's John Tlil's, you know, centuries-old legacy or Knight of Peace. Or even, you know, the organization of Pride March, right? One of them said, you know, I'm a Jerusalemite. This is what I want my city. But all of that. But then, I don't know. I just feel like they don't... The road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? More or less. But here it seems like the road to hell is paved with self-conceited knowledge or acknowledgement that I know best or I am Jerusalem. So leave it up to me, you know? And me asking you that, you know, this is why I'm asking you that, having known these characters and having been around. And by the way, you're also, I mean, you're older than me with what, 10 years or so, something like that. you have lived Jerusalem much longer than I have. You know more nightlife, nighttime spots in Jerusalem than I have. You have seen shit that we will come to later on. Adding one to the other and all this, don't you feel like in the end you've documented a society that's completely lost? A society that's trying to find its way?
I don't know if lost is... I mean, I understand what you're saying. And I don't know if lost is the right word.
Confused?
And I don't know if confused is the right word. And that is basically kind of the question. What is that word that you kind of described right now? Now,
yeah.
I lived here until I was 21. Then I left. Then I came back. Then I left. And I actually only came back 6 years ago.
All right. Okay?
So for me, it's like an ongoing, it's like...
on an off relationship?
No, I'll tell you exactly what it is. It's like Jerusalem for me is kind of like, it's like the first love you had in elementary school. You know, the first time you felt love, you know, when you were like...
19.
15 or 16 or something. Nice. Whatever. You were not, whatever age. But you never forget... her. You'll never forget her. You'll always remember her. The others will come and go, but the first one, and that's how I feel about Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was the first place that I ever felt connected to. Because you know, I grew up in French Hill, okay? And as a child, I saw the first intifada happen in front of my eyes, in front Isawiya and Shu'afat, and I used to go to the British cemetery, and I used to walk around there by myself and just at peace between all these graves of the soldiers of the First World War, understanding that historical
weight
that this place has, and then looking at the beautiful flowers and the stones and the symmetric British cemetery, and I would go there and I would be sucked back into time, and I loved that, and I never had that anywhere, even though when I lived in Prague, which is a very medieval historical city and whatnot. And for me, Jerusalem, it's like that first love. You know, she's always there in my mind, in my spirit. And I hate it. I love it. I hate it. I love it. And
there's something about first love that I have to address. That first loves usually tend to be unobtainable. They're unobtainable. In the sense, you know, they stay at a distance, and it's a distance that can never be bridged. If you say Jerusalem is your first love,
that's your opinion.
What, a first love?
Yeah.
Are you with your first love?
No, I'm not.
Are you married with your first love, Josh?
I'm not married with my first love, but she's actually still a very dear friend of mine. So that's good.
Unobtainable.
Yeah, but you know,
you never ended up with your first love.
Okay.
But that's the thing. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, okay, maybe the people here are not lost. Maybe they're not confused. Maybe they're nostalgic for Jerusalem. That is probably in their imagination. Probably. I'm not saying that. But if we approach Jerusalem in this idea that it was my first love. By the way, when I'm drunk, find me Friday night drunk in Jerusalem. I will also tell you, fucking love this city, man. This is a cool city. Wake me up the next morning. I understand that my love is still there. But somehow it's it's unrequited? Is that the word? It's unrequited when you give love but you don't get the love back.
I know, but that's part of life. You know, you can't always give and get. You know, you have to.
But here we're talking about a city.
A city, my friend. Listen,
3,000 years old.
Listen, I feel that
city that people are investing in. You have invested 44 years of 40. How 45. Old are you? 45 years.
Yeah.
You have invested 45 years in the city. And after 45 years, the city comes and tells you, you're not worth the love. You know, that's it.
Listen, I've left and I've came back and I've left and I came back. And that's the whole thing. It's like there's what's inside of you, where you feel your home is, does not mean that you always have to live there. Okay, it doesn't mean that you always need to be there. And I had left. I lived in Tel Aviv for 10 years. I lived in Prague for 5 years. I lived in Montreal for a year. I lived in New York for 2 years. I mean, but when you ask me where are you from, I will say Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is the place that shaped who I am today. And I've always felt very strongly about saying that to people. I'm from Jerusalem.
But another thing that has shaped you, because I would say this, from all the work, from all, you know, the body of work that you have, I guess the most popular one has nothing to do with Jerusalem. It has to do with Tel Aviv.
Correct.
A bombing, a terrorist bombing that you were a victim of.
Correct.
Probably that has shaped you more than Jerusalem, no? Because somebody could argue that, hey, Josh, 45 years of Jerusalem doesn't mean, does not add up, like, it does not stand up next to 1 hour of that traumatic event. And you're actually a product of that event in Tel Aviv rather than all of these years of Jerusalem.
What do you mean proud of that event?
Product.
Product.
Of not that proud. Event. We're not talking about Pride March. Okay, okay. Not everything has to do with Pride March.
A product. I am a product of that event. But before I was a product of that event, I was a product of growing up in Jerusalem. My best friend was killed when I was 10 years old. Okay.
Oh, yeah. How?
He was killed by an Egyptian soldier in the Sinai and he bled to death. He was shot in the leg.
Which year was this?
1985.
What was happening in 1985? Was there war that we don't know about?
No. It was a group of Israelis camping in the Sinai.
Yeah.
We were supposed to be there with them because they're our neighbors.
Okay.
And an Egyptian soldier opened fire on 10 Israelis, killed 7.
Really?
And one of them was my best friend. His name was Amir Baum.
All right.
And so already at the age of 10, I had to deal with the loss of my best friend being shot and bled to death because he was Jewish or an Israeli or Jewish. It didn't start at Mike's place at the bombing. Okay. It was way before. Then witnessing the first Intifada, and then being a soldier in the army, a combat soldier in the army, and being
You're a combat soldier.
Being in Lebanon and Gaza and Hebron. So the Mike's Place thing, yeah, it was. I was in a terrorist attack, and 3 of my friends died, and I made a movie about it.
And a book.
And a book
that graphic came, novel,
and
a right?
And a graphic novel that came out 10 years later. So yes, I here I had the opportunity to turn the tragedy into art. Okay, so here it was the book and the book that I wrote about the bombing was actually therapeutical. The film that I did right after the bombing was just it was a mess. I mean, it was not therapeutical at all. But that didn't shape me. That did not shape me. And to be honest with you, because growing up in Jerusalem and because being confronted with Christianity and Islam and Judaism and Jerusalem syndrome and the Green Line and East Jerusalem and West, needing to know to understand your neighbor, and this is what you get in Jerusalem if you're brought up the right way to understand who is next to you. So for example, when I was a kid, my friend being murdered by an Egyptian soldier made me as a kid very angry against Arabs. Okay. I mean, that's normal. But as I grew up in Jerusalem and I understood what is happening and how the city functions and what's this and what's that and what's the peace process and what's right winger and what's a left winger and what's a socialist and what's a, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. That, you know, so when I grew out of that anger as a kid that I had, you know, because my best friend was killed, you know, he was taken away from me. I remember standing over his grave when I was 10 years old. You know, my parents did not want me to go to that funeral. I did. But
did you fall back to that anger when you survived the Tel Aviv bombing?
That's exactly what I'm trying to get to. I did not fall back to that anger. On the contrary. Mm-hmm. On the contrary. And in the army too. When I was in bad situations, on the contrary. So as a kid, it was a mechanism and I was a child. But that day, and I remember it was October 5th, 1985. That was the day my friend was killed. That was the day that my childhood ended.
All right.
And I went into adulthood immediately. And that's when I had to understand, to start to understand, I'm not in Detroit and West Bloomfield anymore. You know, this is the real deal, man. I'm in Jerusalem. This is like, and of course there was anger. But that anger, you know, I was 10. I would say by the time I was already 13 or 14, when I started to read books and go to the Cinematheque and watch movies, I started to filter all that anger that I had, and it left, and I became a different person, you know, and I didn't have that anger, but that anger was childish, you know, and it was just, you know, I didn't really get it, you know, but I grew out of it.
You
and Jerusalem helped me do that.
How old were you when the first Intifada started?
I was 12.
12.
Yeah.
Which means you were conscious, like you were aware.
Totally, man.
Second Intifada, 22, 23?
Second Intifada, I was, it was 2000, I was 25. But when the second Intifada broke out, I was doing my studies in Prague. And I came back in the middle of the Intifada in January 2003. I came back at the hype of the Intifada. I mean, yeah. Everything was on fire.
Yeah.
And then 3 months after I came back, the suicide bombing happened.
At Mike's place, in Tel Aviv.
In Tel Aviv. I was working there as a bartender. Yeah. And like I said, three friends of mine died. And again, it was like, welcome back.
No, you know what? Because this leads me to an interesting question. I have a Palestinian friend from Bethlehem who's also a filmmaker. He's also 40 plus. Let's say you guys are from the same generation. He also has blue eyes. Now that I think of it, he also has very distinctive blue eyes.
And he's from Detroit.
Yeah, Bethlehem. Yes, the Detroit of Bethlehem. And so he also, you know, he also went through the first Intifada, second Intifada, the wars in between and all that. And he has a theory that says that, you know, the generation that was conscious during the first one, the first Intifada, the wars that happened, the second one and all that, he says that we are the lost generation. That whenever it was our time, he's talking about the generation, whenever it was the generation's time to blossom, to be productive, to take what it was theirs, you know, to go out and work and do shit, they never got the opportunity because this wave, this current, this geopolitical current just repelled them, just sent them back through tragedy, through war, whatever it was. And he says that, you know, the generation probably doesn't know it, but subconsciously, we are a generation that has paid the highest price, or one of the highest price, for these turbulent periods. And I don't know how I'm going to bring it back to it, but him and some of his friends, I don't know if it's even connected, but they're also single. Like, they're 40 plus, they're not married. And whenever you ask them, like, why not? He says, whenever we tried, the geopolitical reality just shoved us back, and then we couldn't ever get there. You know, we could never, you know, settle down, do this, do that. When there was war, I was whisked away to Jordan. When this, you know, it was my university years, you know, the prime of my youth, couldn't live it out. And now that, you know, that's why I'm asking, if you come from the same age and you've been through the same thing, but just on the other side, right?
Exactly. That's the difference here, because there's in Jerusalem, there's a lot of narratives. Right. And that's what's beautiful about Jerusalem, by the way. You can call them narratives. You can call them mosaics. You can call them pieces of the puzzle. So what you're describing to me about your friend in Bethlehem, yes, we are from the same generation, but we have different opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? I mean,
is it just because you're Jerusalem, or because you're also an Israeli Jewish person?
Also because you're, of course. excuse me. I can relate to what he's saying, but I
you don't feel like your generation lost their opportunities.
I think every generation lost their opportunities. I think every generation has its pros and cons. I think every generation has beautiful things to put onto the table, to show, to leave a stamp. I can't. It's, for me personally, it's hard to talk in those big terms as my generation.
And yeah.
I'm more.
You're on the ground.
You're
a tiny.
I'm just, you know, I mean, I can talk about, you know, my family, you know, or whatever, but I can't, like, my generation.
Were there things that you wanted to do after high school that you felt like you couldn't do because of the geopolitical reality? Now, look, hey, no. I know some people are going to say, Apo, you're talking to a privileged white man with blue eyes.
Exactly.
What kind of restrictions does this guy even face in his life? You're probably right, but that's why I'm asking.
Well,
I want to know.
I could tell you the only, like, restrictions. Because of the geopolitical reality, no.
No.
No. No. I mean, I cannot. the only restrictions that ever stopped me were my own behavior or my own things. You know, I mean,
you are infamous for your behavior.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, like I, if you want to blame the bureaucracy and the government, then go ahead, everybody, you know, but I can't tell you, you know, I didn't get this job. I could tell you that when I came back from studying in Prague, it was hard for me to get a job in the film industry because people are like, oh, you went out to study. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're no good for you here. I had that for a while, but that was just in the film industry. I mean, you know, and whatever. I mean, but nothing more like Palestinians have to go through or the Armenians have to go through with being in limbo and not having a status. I never had to deal with that. However, I am aware of it. You know, I know of it. It's something that I'll think about. It's something that, you know, that I think is wrong. You know, but I did not go through that. I only know people who have gone through that.
And after 45 years in Jerusalem, being aware of these hurdles that other people have, as you said, Palestinians, the Armenians, the Greeks, or as they like to call themselves, the Byzantians, you know, knowing the hurdles that they have and knowing what you know and living through what you've lived, do you feel like then there's hope in Jerusalem? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel here?
Listen.
Or we're all screwed?
Well, we're all screwed, but there's no connection to Jerusalem. But, you know,
listen. Hey, man, I prefer being screwed in Amsterdam rather than being screwed in Jerusalem.
Well, you know, listen, I always say this. Jerusalem is not for everybody.
Oof, that's a strong statement.
It's not for everybody at all. And when when people, especially people from Tel Aviv and, you know, other cities in Israel, Israelis, when they say to me, oh, I hate Jerusalem. I hate it. I'm like, why? Because of the religious, because of the Arabs, and all of this racism comes out of these liberal Tel Aviv people. And it's complete bullshit. It's just ignorance. And I'm happy to be able to feel at home in one of the most complicated cities in the world. I feel at home here, if it's in East Jerusalem or in West Jerusalem. I can tell you that in the last 6 years that I've been back in Jerusalem, I've had the pleasure to meet so many more Christian Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians and work with them and go to their houses. I love it. I love crossing those East-West Jerusalem borders, so-called, quote-unquote. And living in this city is the challenge, the ultimate challenge for me as a human, not as a filmmaker, as a human, because we always have to cross these borders. Mm. And the people who live in Tel Aviv or wherever who are scared to come here, they don't want to cross those borders. It's not convenient for them. They don't want to see the conflict. They don't want to see the hardship. They don't want to, they're in a bubble. When I lived in Tel Aviv, that was the hardest thing for me, living in that fucking Tel Aviv bubble. Excuse me, can I say that?
Yeah, you can say that, man. Feel free.
When you're living in that bubble, it killed my soul. So I can live in Jerusalem and there's hard times going on here and there's whatever, but I know that I'm up against big forces in the city, the spiritual forces, magnetic forces, whatever you want to call them. And I'm on the front line, you know?
And you're here to stay then.
And like I said, it's always here in my heart, the city.
That was a political campaign speech as far as I'm concerned.
Well, no, it's not.
Would you not want to be the mayor one day?
I would never want to have anything to do with any kind of politics ever. But anyways, that's another topic.
What, you wouldn't want to be the mayor?
Never.
So anyways, somebody tells you you're going to be the mayor, Josh.
Are you kidding me, man?
And then you can say, yeah, you know what? What pride? We're going to do Pride March 5 times a month. You are the mayor.
But what I'm saying is, like, Jerusalem is not for everybody. It's a city that is strictly not for everybody. And when people tell me that they can't deal with Jerusalem or it's too, I understand them. When they say I hate Jerusalem, then I just turn my back on them. Because
a lot of people say it.
Yeah, a lot of people say it, and it's just complete.
Have you never said it?
Complete ignorance.
Has the thought never crossed your mind?
No.
Never?
No. Listen, I've been upset. I've been hurt. But, I mean, you know, Jerusalem is a city that bruises you, you know?
But you never hate the first love.
But you never turn your back on your first love.
You're right about that. Before I finish this conversation, just one more question.
Please.
How is the dating scene in West Jerusalem? We're not going to talk about East Jerusalem. I don't know when was the last time you dabbled in East Jerusalem dating scene. I would argue that there isn't really one to talk about. But anyways, how is the dating scene in West Jerusalem? Now we're talking more about your blue eyes.
That's a very interesting question. That's your...
You're a 45-year-old single man walking the streets of Jerusalem.
I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment on that.
You could have just said it's a good dating scene.
That's it. Nothing really to write home about.
So there's a better dating scene in Prague? Dude, this is a city that you are, you know, you just made a heartfelt rally for. Like, I don't know, you know.
Listen, I mean, when you say what's the dating situation, I mean, the dating situation is it's something that's dependent on yourself, on your personality. Okay, you can you know, so I mean, it has nothing to do with the city. Okay, so I could tell you that for the last 2 years, I haven't really dated anybody, but that was my choice. It has nothing to do with Jerusalem. So I don't think I'm the correct person to ask that question, but I could find somebody for you who could, you know, do I get to make a phone call? What's it called, a millionaire? When you
the
get
millionaire
a,
thing, you, get you a, call a relative or somebody.
You call a relative or something. But I do want to just say that Jerusalem.
Talk into the mic.
I'm sorry. Jerusalem is, it's, you know, it's an enigma. It's something that's...
But I feel like people say that about every city or their own cities. Yeah, you know, these big cities or these mystical cities?
Let's put it this way.
Beirut, I'm pretty sure the Beirutis say that about Beirut.
Listen, I'll put it to you this way. Jerusalem has been conquered by 26 different nations. Okay? It's been destroyed and burnt to the ground twice.
Now you sound like a Serb.
Besieged, I don't know how many times. One thing I can tell you is that Jerusalem is constantly changing hands, and it always will. Okay? Even now that the Jews or the Israelis, you want to call
them.
Are
you threatening Bibi Netanyahu?
No, I'm just saying that Jerusalem is a city. If you look at its history, it's 3,500 years of history.
Yeah.
You will see a very simple graph. It's constantly changing hands. If it's the Ottomans, if it's the British, if it's the Israelis now, it's not always going to stay in the Israelis' hands. It's going to keep on shifting as it has always. The Romans, the Byzantines, the Greeks, the Mamluks, whatever. And that's Jerusalem. It's like being at the craps table. You know what the
and you're okay with that?
Absolutely.
As an Israeli Jewish guy.
Listen, I happen to live here in the time where I'm privileged to live under the Israeli, you know, that Jerusalem is in the hands of the Israelis. But will this be in the next in 200 years from now? I have no idea. Look back at the history, and you will see that Jerusalem is constantly changing hands, and it probably will.
And on that great optimistic note, or, you know, historic note.
And that's why you need to be very respectful and understanding of who else is living with you in Jerusalem.
Of course, man. That's what I try to say to everybody. But
I'm saying it to you right now.
People don't listen to me.
No, I listen to you.
You do, but you're like one out of a people.
Hey, man, you know.
But hey, they don't have your blue eyes. And as long as they don't have your blue eyes, screw everybody else. I'm going with you. Anyways, people, that was it. I'm going to finish this up. Thank you for hearing Apo in the City. Hopefully we elucidated and illuminated some parts of the history's dynamics or the city's dynamics. We think we did? I think we did.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Thanks, Apo. I appreciate it.
No worries. This was done in like spur of the moment.
Yes, it was.
It was done in spur of the moment. All right. See you soon.